What was your husband's reaction to this book?
The first time he read the book, he only read, I think I had probably a third of the book done, and I had been saving them up so that there would be some context for him to see, because at the time, every little chunk started My Lover, and that would go on, and I was, for obvious reasons, really worried about how he would respond as a non-creative writer to that manuscript. And when he got to the fourth one, and he called me in, he was in the other room, and he said, well, come here, and I came in, and he was like, well, I think by the fourth poem, it's obvious this isn't a real human. And I said, oh, okay, now I feel better. I can go on with continuing to write the book.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Amy Rotto Parks about her mosaic novel, Radial Bloom. It's a lyrical, haunting window into a love like no other. And it's called a mosaic novel, a verse novel, as well as a series of prose poems. Yeah. How have you been describing it to your friends and family?
Actually, that was part of the thing that made me the most nervous about this. I was like, I don't really know what to say about this book sometimes. And it makes me chuckle a little bit that it still gets called a lot of different things because I didn't know what it was when I was writing it either. And I'm a poet, so I imagined I was writing poems. And I think I just describe it as a story about two people. Because when I was working on it, I asked a friend who is a fiction writer, can you have a novel that has plot and character but no scene, like no stable setting? Basically, mm-hmm. It has scene. But and he said, I can't say no. That was the answer. And I was like, so it's a story. And beyond that, I feel like people read in what they want. I've had a lot of interesting responses to what it's about. And so that makes me kind of happy with just calling it a story of some kind.
The book is set off by a prologue that has a different tone, where you establish what you call a privileged normalcy and write, before you know the rest, you should know this. I live in a pleasant house on a quiet street in a modern-day Mayberry with mountains. Why begin there?
Well, one, I really, when I wrote this, I didn't imagine it as a novel. It felt very real to me, the entire story. And so it felt important to give it actual grounded context, to say, like, this is actually a house. Like, these scenes I describe are actually my house. They're in a place that exists that's really just blandly normal most of the time, which is a thing that, like, the kind of things that are normal to me are not just normal for everybody. So it is, remains like the things I'm going to describe are like extra Norman Rockwell sounding, right? But on a more logistical writing level, all of the people, all my most trusted readers, when they read the beginning of it, just said, oh my God, the beginning is awful. It's brutal. I can't get through it. It's too muscular. It's too ugly. And I sat with that for a long time, but couldn't figure out how to, but I wanted to end beautiful. And it kind of was ugly at the beginning. And so I played around with writing a prologue for it. And a couple of people really said they didn't think it needed it. But I really like it. I mean, I know for people here in Missoula especially, they're like, oh, all of that sounds normal.
And Kecha Kuipers writes, for those of us tucked safely into a life that has been domesticated by a partner and children, there is a tendency to wonder where that person we were before has disappeared to. Which made me wonder, Amy, who are you recovering in this book?
Yeah, a lot of this book really is for me, it's a lot of things, but I think, you know, the real catalyst for this book was a conversation with a girlfriend that we were talking about how we'd both known our husbands for a very, very long time. And I met my husband when I was 19, and she met hers in middle school, and they had dated on and off middle school, high school, back and forth. And I said, how could you possibly still, how did you end up together? And she said, I think he was just the lover I couldn't forget. And I thought about that so much, and I realized, like, to me, that's what writing was. I was like, oh, I do all these other things that are explicitly not about being a poet as a career, but I just can't forget it. And so that's why each piece would start out, my lover is. And so to me, writing is really about a muse that is like a ghost, that is like a part of a self that is just difficult to reconcile. And it's hard to make sense of in daily life, and a part of yourself that experiences things differently than the part of yourself that interacts with other people, you know, that kind of lives in the ceiling, mm-hmm. Looking down on everything. And it's feels very split. And so as the book kept going, that was very much where I was like, oh, I hide it away. And so in this book, it was very, every time I read it, I still get, like, I feel like I didn't write it. I have that experience again of being like, oh, it can all be all in one person. Mm. It doesn't have to be hidden or split. And yeah, I get so emotional just thinking about it.
I was so struck by this sense of what little I know about you as a human in this community. And then, yeah. And then the speaker in this book is you inhabit that wild space.
Yeah.
So radically really. Clear. Yeah.
Well, and I had, when I came here for my MFA, I had Patricia Godica as a faculty member who was constantly, so she said two things to me that drove me insane. And one is that she said I was terrible with line breaks. Every time I would turn in a poem, she was like, oh, your line breaks are so ugly. And I was like, oh, how can they all be ugly universally? And we would argue. And many years later, I said, oh, I should just take them all out, which as we can see in this book, I just basically took them all out. But she constantly would criticize me for not unleashing. Mm-hmm. She was like, you're just not being wild. And at the time, I was like, are you joking? I have two tiny children and right. I'm in grad school. I know I am not wild. but I remembered it always because I was like, oh, it is in there. And I just don't know what to do with it. And I remember when I finished this, I was like, oh, I can't believe I can't show her this book.
Yes, exactly.
Because it felt very secretive because of that. Yeah. Like it was, well, it took 10 years. I wrote this 10 years ago to be like, here you go, world.
Right. I want to enter the seductive space of the book, including the he.
Yeah.
And the first epigraph is from Emily Dickinson. He stuns you by degrees. And I just actually, I want to have you launch into a reading, would
you? Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I might say, so what I'm going to read, yes, is the end of the prologue and then this first piece. And I think both of them do a similar thing for me in situating it in a normal space, because there was a very, very specific corner at the kids' school where we always stood. So this was very literally like a space that was important to me. Once there was a man who came to me and stayed, or he had always been there and never left, or he was a muse born of my prayers. Or he was my every shame, or my every fear, or my every love risen up in the shape of a man. Or he was a simple ghost trying to find the light. This is his story, and mine. We met abruptly on the corner near the kids' school. He was running toward me, hand inside his jacket, searching for a weapon. I imagined a knife through my ribs or a cord around my neck, but then he was so close to me and I was afraid and could not move, and his hand rose from the black coat and there was a golden gun lifted in the air and he fell toward me, plunging it through my chest and resting against my heart, gold against red, and the trigger went and I was exploded. I stood there on the corner. No one knew and no one saw a thing. I exploded and no one saw a thing. Is this possible? If you wonder, then you have never before fallen in love.
When I read that first page, that first piece, it was immediately resonant. And it made me think, like, Amy, how if you've been in your marriage since your late teens, how do you remember the acuity of that moment?
That feeling. And, you know, I have to say now, because I wrote this so long ago, one thing that was interesting about it, my kids were so small when I wrote it, like 3 and 5. But during the years when I was revising it, they were much older. And so getting to re-experience some of those things through kids that are in middle and high school, and having that sense that you can just feel like when you watch somebody else just be lit up by another person, and they don't even totally know how visible it is to other people or how clear that like eruption is. And it is very much transported back into that sense of like suddenly everything is different. Mm. It's all changed. Like chemically, it just feels completely ruined and rebuilt in like 1 second. Yeah.
And there's a way that I am walking two tracks as I read your work. One is this sort of literal explosion of an encounter, and the other is this more ghost-like muse element. And if I'm thinking about this character as the muse, you know, you write, I wanted the words his presence brought. He came and I wrote. And he was the bright dream life of untold stories. What is your relationship to the muse?
You know, this was definitely a different relationship to it. And the ghost story part of this is interesting because I do literally see ghosts. And I mean, I do have very intense experiences. And that was actually a part of working with this book. But a lot of writing has always felt really delivered to me, like really not a choice. And this book in particular. So I wrote all of this, and it was actually much longer, in 5 weeks, during one 5-week chunk that was very much a takeover of everything. But some of my favorite things I've ever written have very much, it feels like they're just delivered. And that if I'm alert enough to listening to it, then I can have those experiences alongside the other parts of daily life that just aren't always inspiring, but that it arrives somehow. And so that is very much like, to me, the daily life is very full of a muse, I guess, but that a lot of times it is just about me hearing it in some way.
And what about the nature of the woman in the book? What is she vulnerable to? What is her desire?
Yeah, there's a part in this book that I've never been able to totally sort out. And it's a part where he says we're the same and the speaker can't figure out exactly, doesn't have a reaction, doesn't know. And I have never been able to sort that out completely myself about whether or not that's supposed to be a moment where, because it's a moment where that he is being horrible and truly being wild, truly being doing bad things and being, you know, really high and hurting himself and really questioning whether or not that is the same for the speaker. I don't know. Really, say the end of what you asked again.
What is her desire?
What does she want? I think to be freed of it, to be freed of the to be able to reconcile going toward something without consequence, like going toward the thing without giving up. Like we have a perception about writing, and I think it matters, like in Keisha's commentary, it matters that I wrote this when my kids were small because it's such a high demand time. And we have this identity of being a parent or being a mother in particular that says when you're a mother, you must give all of this to your children, or what are you as a mother? And I actually did a panel my first year of grad school with AWP that was called If You're Crazy Enough to Write, Are You Sane Enough to Mother?
Wow.
I think was the title. And so I think at the time it was really like, can I have both of these things at the same time? What will happen? Am I really going to sacrifice one or the other? And really, really wanting it to be okay to have both parts.
Yeah. That's what this book seems to be able to hold, is the longing and coloring outside the lines as well as the normalcy of putting kids to bed.
Yeah. I mean, early on in the first section, there's so much description of the he openly criticizing, which is very much, when I look at it, I'm like, oh, that was very much during that time. A self-criticism, like, this is what you're doing again. Like, this is what you're spending your time doing. You're wiping the counters down again. And those are moments, we all have moments where, like, is this really what I'm doing with my life right now? When there's this other thing that did exist and you know it's still there, or you wonder if it's still there and you can't tell.
Right.
It is.
And in the voice of the speaker, you write, it was clear then that he was mine to protect.
Yeah.
What did you mean by that?
Yeah, there's, I think, a really shifting back and forth power dynamic in this. Like, is this mine or is it not mine? Yeah, the idea that I was actually creating this because I needed it to be a thing and that it wasn't something taking over me, that there was an exchange happening. It wasn't an unwilling experience, that there was something I was going after, even though I was really unsure if I was going after it.
Mm-hmm.
And that, is it okay to want a thing that isn't your family? Is it okay to want writing that is just private? It doesn't serve your family. It doesn't, what does it do? But it is a part of how you live in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Will you read another section?
Yeah. Throughout all of this, I reminded myself that he was not my man. Was not the silvery net, fine as birth call, that encased me at night, that reminded me that I would not drown, that I could breathe in all that water, that placed his hands on me, holding me to the earth. He was not the body that was my air, that entered and remade me, was not the one that fed my body and reminded it to live here on earth, on the shore where our feet could always land, and having landed, could move forward.
you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Amy Rado Parks about her book, Radial Bloom. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook.
I love this intersection of fish metaphors and fishing and birthing, right? You write all about stillborn, and you also write, he was there at my birth watching my mouth on my mother's breast. What do you know about the instinct to go towards those metaphors?
Well, for me, there's very much a spiritual aspect to this, where that part of me that has this was always there. And I feel like that writing, I think that's why writing feels like home, and it gets very confused because of that. It's like the home inside myself, but it's not physical home. You can birth writing. You create a thing and you create a human, but they don't come from the same place. And the idea that you can continue to be reborn and live these different lives in one lifetime and feel these different ways and these different experiences is endlessly interesting to me, that we don't just end in a place and are like, oh, I'm here, I'm done now. And I think all of those things are really entwined for me. And really this section is about so much about my husband, who is also a fisherman, you know, and intimately connected to water, but really is like a grounding force for me. And he, beyond all like reasoning, is able to appreciate and read and critique and offer commentary on all of my creative work just purely by being like humanly interested. Yeah. And it remains like a loving gesture that I could have never imagined that somebody would give, to be like, I don't know about poetry, but I'll read this 5 times and see if I can figure it, you know, and then ask like all the questions that I would show up and have other readers ask at the same time.
And I wanted to just like lean into the fishing metaphor a bit more. And you manage to keep the tension on the line, right? Mm-hmm. If it's too slack, you know, the reader will lose themselves. And if it's too taut, the fish will break off. And so I'm thinking, how did you balance the pacing of the work?
That's a really good question. And I think a lot of that had to do with really revising it over many years, because I wrote it so quickly that and of course, when you write something quickly, you think it's the best thing that's ever been written on the planet. And after you've written a bunch of things and have that experience, you know that's not true.
Right.
But you still give it to your best friends and say, you should say this is amazing. And then they do. And then later they're like, cut 1/3 of it. You know. But the ordering of some of these things, in a lot of ways, it's exactly how it came out, except for the end, which I didn't have for a very long time. But linking them together was very much like, sometimes it just felt so harsh. To me, it was as much thinking about it in a musical sense. Like if something is so discordant, you stop wanting to listen. Mm-hmm. But if it can lighten a little bit and come back, then it remains, the sense of its gravity remains, instead of just like pounding on something over and over again.
Can you speak to one of the moments then of resolution where you feel like you go discordant and then it resolves for a breath and then goes discordant?
This is one of my favorite ones, I think, because of that thing of trying to figure out, it's very uncomfortable to actually, I mean, if you actually are doing this, which I grew up playing baseball and we would try all the time, and it was actually scary because the baseball was going to hit you in the face. But it's also a gentle game that both people are participating in. We tossed a baseball at dusk. The white ball between us struggled to hold the fading light, to distinguish itself in the boundaryless static light. Then a light snow began. We agreed that we should stop, that it was too hard to see, that we only knew the ball when it was suddenly a blare of red stitches too close. We could have agreed to throw more gently. We could have agreed to different circumstance. We could have decided, in fact, that the game itself was cliché, but that would have been a betrayal on its own. We both wanted to be here for the solid smack of the ball in the mitt, the hard knot of leather in the palm before release, the miracle of the light and the silent blind air for all those moments before we knew for sure we'd made contact.
What I want the listeners to know is you establish the intensity of this connection, right, and the presence of it, and then he leaves.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. And when this was when I was writing this book, I sat at the depot with my friend Natalie and I just cried and cried and cried.
Yeah.
I was like, my book's going to end. And it was so like, it was very much like a person leaving,
right.
You know? And of course she's another poet, you know, and she's like, it's okay.
It's okay.
You know, there are only certain people you go to for certain kinds of comfort.
Yeah.
And I was like, but I don't know what's going to happen. Like, at the time, I was like, I just did a thing. I don't know. What is it? Is it a thing? Did I just finish it? It's just like, I don't know, taking a class and it's done. And I knew then that it couldn't really be done because I was so attached to it, like
yes,
a person.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so how did you work through that part of the process?
I didn't do anything with it for like 5 years. That was pretty much the only way. Yeah, because all the people I trusted the most did actually say to cut a third of the words. And I would look at it and I believed them, which is why you have trusted readers, but I just didn't know. I couldn't cut any of it. It felt whole still. And so I finally, after 5 years, I decided that 5 years was enough. Like if I couldn't cut it, I was never going to be able to cut it. And so I started cutting it and I sent it various places, but it's not a genre that fit anywhere. And so it seemed like a silly waste of money. And then I sent it to my friend Meg, and she said, it needs an introduction. It needs an agent. Like, somebody has to introduce it to somebody else.
A doula.
And you don't have, yeah, exactly. Like, somebody needs to say, here's a thing. You should read it. And you can't do that yourself as an author. And so she connected me up with a really awesome agent. And it was actually maybe one of the scariest things to send it off, even though nobody even knew I sent it at all.
Yes.
You know? Because I knew I would... It's easy to do things if you don't care about failing at it or care about being rejected, but I super cared, you know, so it was very, and of course, I mean, he wrote me back 2 days later and said, I've read the first third, but I have a lot of questions. I don't know who the he is, and I don't, and he asked, and I said, I think those are actually the pivotal questions of the whole book, so I hope you know by the end.
Yes.
If not, get back to me, you know, and he did. He was like, oh, you told me on the first page.
Yes.
And so... That very much. But then, and so it took a couple of years from moving from that into it actually coming about.
Wow, what a process.
It was. And then to have it be so long after, like, my kids are at reading age where they could read it.
Exactly.
It's not where it was when I, you know, was writing it.
I was reading some of the blurbs, and about the book, Chris Dombrowski writes, imagine Julian of Norwich, Baudelaire, and John Wayne sitting at the bar with Dante pouring shots. And it's true, in the back, you include these nods and notes yeah. to John Wayne, Dante, T.S. Eliot, among others. How did the invocations come to you?
Well, a lot of those writers are people I've studied a lot. And I had long in the back of my head, I'd always heard people say, you can't really try to have a project with creative work, but good projects happen, you know, when you have them in your mind. And so I had done, I had wanted to come to grad school to study Dante, and then I kind of changed gears and studied T.S. Eliot and felt very hyper-conscious about the fact that all of the authors I really loved from medieval times and religious writing and the modernist era were all men. And I love Virginia Woolf, but not quite in the same way. And also men that were very culturally complicated and not harmless humans, right? Mm-hmm. And so it was very difficult for me to reconcile, like, The Wasteland and T.S. Eliot with my own work. And I had studied so much of them that a lot of the nods that came out were just things that I knew when I was writing it. Mm-hmm. But the thing I had long had in mind is that I really would want to write it and take it back, like, take back what they're doing and recast it. And it is mostly men that are from the canon that I just want to use their words in this completely different kind of context to own them, I guess, mm-hmm. in that way, to be able to say this is a woman writing a text about these things, and they can also be ugly and beautiful at the same time, and also full of like a muscular masculinity and a really gentle feminine part. It doesn't have to be one or the other, and all those things can live in one book. And I think definitely there. By the time I was reworking some of these, I was very thoughtful about being able to make sure that those moments were working, mm-hmm. And that I wasn't making it over much of a project. But yes, that was very much, and I do still love all of that writing so much. But it was always something I was very thoughtful of in my own choices in grad school.
Will you read us one more section?
Yes. He was a black axis, a beautiful swarm, the hollow-boned flight, the birds through a metal tunnel funneling out into a black flock, forming and reforming the images made of their proximity and distance. All space and feathered axis after feathered axis, sometimes flat, sometimes turned to the light, to the horizon, to me. Into the bulrushes, into the giant talus, into the wheat crop, and I was the empty hive, the egg wash, the straw-headed, diffuse and edgeless, a place where something once lived. And I was the crow blowing over, looking for the waste of him, waiting to scavenge the ineffable message as it pulsed out of him like radio waves or a beacon or an accidental crossbeam of light.
My last question for you is, what's your advice or warning to those entering their own radio bloom spaces?
You know, I would share advice that somebody gave me when I was working on this, and it was someone I had worked with when I was working in publishing, and I was very, very unsure about what this book was and was trying to do my best to just follow it without trying to control it, which is not really my nature or most people's probably. And so I wrote to him and I said, I'm working on this book, but I don't know what it is. Like, is it, I don't know how to craft it into whether it's supposed to be a story or essays or poems. And I don't know what it is. And he wrote back, I've thought about it so many times. And he was like, well, if you're swimming, it doesn't really matter what stroke it is. You just have to keep swimming forward. And whatever stroke you're using will just get you there as long as you can keep going. And it really reminded me that I didn't have to know what the whole thing was, except that I was still attached to it. It was still alive. And so, and that's advice we hear people say all the time. If you control it too quickly, it can't keep living. And so I really did need to hear that, like to just keep going into the, whatever the big question is that hasn't been solved yet. And just to have actually honestly faith that the pursuit of the question is enough without having to be able to know the whole box it's going to fit in.
Amy Rotto Parks lives in Missoula, Montana. She is the author of 2 chapbooks of poetry and teaches at the University of Montana. Look for more information about her and her work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.